Minister of Care Collection and Chair of the Committee on Health and Policy and Planning and Public Health Plan, Commissioner of Minnesota Hospital Representatives. And we're here at the invitation of your state representative, Representative Marshall Quill. And we're going to have a chance to hear tonight from a number of cities and cities that have all the chance to hear from you. I'm going to start by letting Representative Quill.
Thank you, Representative Clark. It's just a real pleasure to be here this evening and to especially welcome the Department of Health and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and to know that they have been working so diligently on the testing and looking at the requests that the legislature made of them this past session. The issues around PFCs were made public about a year ago, and it's been a very interesting journey during this period of time. Learning about the chemicals that we have here in this part of Washington County, and also learning about ways that we can hopefully deal with getting them removed from the soil and also cleaning up our aquifers. It would be probably impolite of me not to mention that over the weekend we lost an individual who is the county commissioner by the name of Greg Orr, who died very tragically down in Mankato. And I just want all of us to be aware of the deep commitment that Greg had to our community. He was the sheriff here in Woodbury for 30 years before he became a county commissioner. And was just such a wonderful person and so incredibly proud of this community. So I hope that all of you will join with me and the senator and representatives that are at the table this evening in extending our heartfelt sympathy to the whole family. With that said, I would like to also let Senator Paulson greet you, and I'm sure she has some questions.
It's a pleasure to be here with the House Committee, and to echo Representative Quill's comment, it was about a year ago that we became aware of PFCs in our water, and when you look back at what has happened in the past year, it's really very remarkable about the fact that we were in session at the time, we were able to look at potentially what we could do in terms of legislation. We'll be hearing about some of that tonight, but also the fact that all the stakeholders came to the table and what has been accomplished. Certainly, I think that everybody wants things to happen faster, but when you look at situations across the country where there has been, these kind of issues, where we're at today is really very remarkable. And to all the stakeholder groups who have worked with us on that, I just want to say thank you. We should be very proud of not only our community and how we've responded, but the fact that our corporate citizens have also come to the table, and that's been very, very important. So again, thank you all for being here tonight.
Representative Julie Bunn. I represent the northeast corner of Woodbury, and I serve on the two Health and Human Service Committees in the House, and have been very involved in this issue from the beginning as well. And I want to particularly thank our chair today, Representative Karen Clark, because you'll be hearing about three pieces of legislation that were passed in conjunction with all the area legislators working together this last session in order to respond to this issue. And Representative Clark was one of a couple of chairs. Player in finding the funding for and the mechanism for getting this legislation passed. We'll be hearing about the membership for efforts on that. But we've had some meetings with 3M, we've had meetings with NCPA on mental issues throughout the district, and yet tonight we'll be hearing more on these issues, and I hope that you'll find this going forward. So thank you for coming out tonight.
Can I represent the Carol Lee from the Coming Heights, Quincy, Tennessee area?
As I mentioned earlier, Representative Karen Clark, I represent three inner city neighborhoods in South Minneapolis, those neighborhoods, Woody and Quincy, and Curry neighborhoods. And this city has been very committed to the issues of environmental health and environmental justice. So that's why we're here tonight. Thank you for being here.
Just one group that I'm remiss in welcoming tonight, and I have a extra credit in it, but I have a lot of students here tonight. So thank you guys for coming, and I hope that you find it interesting.
We'll discuss it tomorrow. I'm Representative Ken Schumper. I represent a rural district way down in the southeastern corner of our state, Houston and Gilmore County.
I am Kofi Peterson in Bloomington Heights.
Okay, well, I originated to hear from several of the James, because we start with the Minnesota Department of Health, who's in the University of Michigan Science. So welcome to the city. Introduce yourself to the evening.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for the invitation and for the opportunity to testify about the work we've been doing. It has been an incredible amount of work, looking for any combinations with the governor on my extra credit and the extra credit of the any agencies that are here tonight to talk about our work. So we appreciate the chance to tell our story. Last year, as Representative Swales mentioned, we were just beginning a process at this time of year to inform the public about the emergence of groundwater contamination in the southern part of Washington County, and with a number of chemical compounds that were historically manufactured by the Pickering Company. And you're right, I also agree with what you said, Representative Swales, and their thoughts on what the amount of effort and coordination required to get the kind of work done to be accomplished, and we're very proud of that. I'm very appreciative of the partnership that has existed between the 3M Company and the local units, the government, the legislature, and the state agencies. So we're very much in agreement with the way we characterize it. Since we learned of the contamination in the southern part of the county, we've sampled more than 900 wells over the past year. Those sampling efforts have led us to understand better the extent of the contamination through the various aquifers that underlie this part of the state. Aquifers are the bedrock formations that supply the water that we all drink. Certainly municipal wells, private wells throughout this area are supplied by three or four major aquifers, all of which to some extent have been decontaminated at very low levels. And tonight what we're going to do is give you an update on three of the projects that we were directed to undertake from last year's legislative session. The first project we'll talk about is the biomonitoring effort. There will be some upcoming public meetings the week after next. And Gene Johnson and Michelle Zotran from our chronic disease division will be up here to talk about that. We also are going to give an update on the water treatment device study that we've been conducting. The legislature provided $640,000 to the department to conduct a survey and a study of point-of-use filters. Those are the types of filtering units that are typically kitchen sink-type units, either on your countertop or under your sink. And we'll give an update on that. And then we're going to give a little progress report on the development of the health-based water for PFBA, which is one of the acronyms for perfluorooctanoic acid. And Dr. Helen Gating of the department will be providing that update. So with that, I'd answer any general questions, but we could also just launch right into the biomonitoring project update if that's all right. Any questions that you have to ask those? Great, thank you. I'd like to call Dr. Gene Johnson and Michelle Richard and the president.
Each of two communities likely to have been exposed to PFCs.
meeting in October, our scientific advisory panel made a recommendation that this pilot project be conducted in the city of Washington County, an area where drinking water has found and with CFPs. As a permanent proposal, two communities that we have selected for the pilot project, they are defined not by geographic boundaries, but by the drinking water source. The first community is comprised of all households that are served by the Oregon Municipal Water Supply, which represents approximately 27,000 people in Oakdale, and there are about 9,000 city water connections from the Oakdale Water Supply. The second community is comprised of households with private wells that are known to be contaminated with PFOA or PFOS above trace levels. There are approximately 150 of these households, and they are located in parts of Lake Elmo and Cottage Grove. All of these private wells that we discussed here are also contaminated with PFB agents. So the selection of these communities based on known drinking water contamination, they were chosen because this increases the likelihood that project participants will have been exposed in the past to two or more PFBs. And then to further increase the likelihood of detecting PFB exposure, we propose to limit eligibility to adults aged 20 years and over who lived in the household before January 1, 2005. This is prior to the time when contamination was discovered in the area. This is being done because of carbon filtration systems and other conventions that are now in place. Many, if not all, of the households in these affected communities are not currently drinking the contaminated water. We expect the analysis of the biospecimens, which in this case is blood serum, would most likely detect past exposure to PFCs that have a long half-life of 7 years in the body. We did not select communities where the only contamination detected in the water supply was PFOA. This is because PFOA has a very short half-life, only 7 days in the body, whereas PFOA and PFOA have a half-life of 7 years. So if we did detect PFOA, we would only expect to find that if there was current ongoing exposure to PFOA. Currently, NPA staff are in the process of developing specific protocols for this project, including our methods for selecting and inviting participants, obtaining samples, and collecting samples. On December 17th, our advisory panel reviewed and discussed the specifics of some of those NPA protocols. As we proceed on our plan, we are taking steps to ensure that the project is designed in a way that will be accessible to the community and working to inform community members, local elected officials, and other stakeholders about the project and to solicit their input. Some of the methods that we're using to engage the public are letters to all the legislators in the district, as well as some neighboring districts. These went out a couple of weeks ago. Meetings with county and municipal officials have been held. A news release, Metro News Outlet, the community papers went out, I think that was about a week ago. We are planning to conduct outreach to physicians and medical facilities in the area when it gets closer to the point that we are actually recruiting participants. And then, as was mentioned earlier, we have open community meetings that are planned. Three of them are scheduled for the end of this month, one in Lake Elmo, one in Cottage Grove, and one in Oakdale. At the conclusion of this process of speaking to the input and reviewing the protocols with our science advisory panel, the next step is to prepare an application for submission to the NPH Institutional Review Board, along with all the study materials and consent documents. And anytime you have studies that involve human subjects, there are institutional review boards, also called IRBs, that are required to assure protection of human subjects' rights. This review covers things on ethical considerations such as the informed consent process, the risks and benefits of participation, and also all data privacy protections. With biomonitoring studies, there are additional ethical considerations, such as the rights of study subjects to information about the results and to biospecimen collection and storage. The laws governing human subject protection, which are found in the U.S. Code of Federal Regulations. So that is the final step. Once we have received IRB approval, which we hope will be in April, we would expect to actually begin contacting recruited participants probably in May or possibly June. We would expect to be out in the field in the summer. That concludes my comments.
Any questions? Any questions?
What
when people come down to study, and the other question about the half-life, the half-life is, say, 6 years. Will you be able to go back and determine the original exposure time?
We will not, as part of this study, and I'm not certain if it's possible to do that, but that's not something we've mandated on this study. I mean, theoretically, I think you could probably do some calculations of estimating when the exposure occurred, because there's a half-life in the body. But that's not part of our planning.
What do you think?
Oh, yes, and I'll just say, it goes well, and we're in the field this summer. We are recruiting 200 people, collecting 200 blood samples. Hopefully that will be completed over the summer, and we'll be able to complete all the laboratory analysis throughout the fall, and actually have feedback a year from now in January with a report back to the legislature on the report.
I have a question. You're limiting this to adults, and yet, if anyone is 3 years of age or older, would be exposed and somewhat more vulnerable than adults, it would seem to be because of their rapid life cells and immune system differences that they have from adults. Why is this being limited to adults and not including children? If I understood you correctly, because of the 205 information that was out there, although I presume that not everybody can access the alteration, so you can just say it if everyone did. You're talking about index 3 years, major older, so why the limitation of those?
Just a couple of reasons. One is a practical consideration. This does involve collecting a blood sample. And the other point is that this is a pilot project. We only have 200 subjects. And we'll be comparing the result to national data that's collected as part of the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. The NIH actually does collect blood samples from children, however, they do that as part of a much larger nutrition study. Our plan is to compare results to adult data from the national survey, and that's why one of the reasons we're limiting it to adults, so that because we do have a national comparison with people age 20 and up that we have seen. But the other is, isn't this a practical consideration of the difficulties of collecting blood samples of children? It would require an extra step in addition to getting parental consent. We also have to get child assent. So it just adds an extra step to it, and it adds an extra comparison group. Just reminding you, we did discuss this with the advisory panel. Was there their opinion and their recommendation that the adults would be the proper target for this particular class?
Just a question. Are you only thinking about simple, not here or here? Which would be easier to collect from children, of course. I kind of wonder, when you leave children out, they put into the secondary death, I'm not so sure that we're going to get, the most vulnerable people. But anyway, are you going to be looking at other avenues?
We're looking at blood for PFCs. That is the best medium for detecting PFCs, and like I say, it does give us a comparison to a national sample. I think you're aware that in South Minneapolis, we actually are looking at arsenic levels in the urine of children there. So we do have a pilot project that will be addressing children, and we'll be looking at urine samples there.
Final question. Thank you. This is a question that's on my mind as well. A different question came from a constituent from the community last week, which was, and I didn't know the answer to it, which is, in the type of information you collect about the individual donating the blood sample, will you be collecting current health status information? Or, if not, what types of information are just roughly maybe lives? So if it's generalized, what kind of information you're collecting on?
And Mr. Representative, that's a very good question. It's certainly one that we've talked about with our work group and with the panel. We do have constraints because this is a pilot, and we're constrained in terms of time and resources. We aren't able to do everything we would like to do. If this were a larger research study, we would certainly have a detailed questionnaire that would be looking at things like health histories and possible sources of exposure. And we'd probably be proposing, some follow-up down the road. But because this is a pilot and we've had to make some choices and limitations, we're going to have just a very brief survey for each of the participants, and it will not be collecting health histories. We will be collecting just a couple of questions about, for example, occupation, did they ever work for 3M at a PFC manufacturing facility, for example. We know from studies that have done at 3M that that would pose a significant source of exposure, so we will be asking about that. We will be asking how long they lived in their home and potentially exposed to the drinking water source. Aside from that, it's going to be a very limited questionnaire to be sure that they're eligible for the study and to get it from the
I'm curious, and Representative Shepard is also very curious about how is the sample selected? Who are you choosing? What qualifies you to be
That's a very good question. We've had a lot of discussion about that as well. And as I mentioned, speaking of the city of Oakdale, where there is 27,000 residents and 9,000 hookups, selecting 100 people, that is a challenge. But the method that we have come up with would essentially be sort of a two-part process where we would, in the case of Oakdale, we would start, we have talked to the city about their municipal billing records that would have a list of all of their customers, all their residential customers, and then from that list, we could randomly select approximately 300 to 500 households. Each of those households would be mailed a letter with a short questionnaire that they could respond back to us with information about any eligible adults in the household. And then from that pool of eligible adults, there would be, you know, part two would be a selection of 100 adults out of that pool of eligible 100 adults that come back from the 500 households. And then we would do something very similar with the private well, except that all 150 households would get the initial questionnaire. That response comes back when we select 100 people from responses to the initial questionnaire. It's essentially a two-step process.
But are you going to include randomization for example, age and for how long they have lived here? Seems to me those are pretty important. You know, if you end up with a sample that's, you know, if your turnover in the community is, say, 25% or so, here you end up with a sample of maybe only 5% of the people who are fairly new, it seems to me you're going to get a really biased sample. So are you going to include longevity or length of residency here as well as age?
Well, as I mentioned, to be eligible to be in the pool to be selected, they must have lived in their home. Again, this is the way we have currently proposed it. We're still, you know, interested in taking comments, but it's currently proposed they must have lived in their home as of January 1, 2005. So anyone who's moved in after that date would not be eligible. So we'd be only looking at folks currently in their residence who've lived there at least that number of years. So anyone meeting that criteria would be eligible and could be selected. So the population that we look at will be representative of all the folks meeting that criteria. So as long as they're over age 20, it should be comparable to the NE data.
Just one more question about this sample. I am concerned that you're not going to be testing children. Are you at least going to make sure that you have some pregnant women? I'm thinking the little ones are the ones that I know that at least when we've talked to people in the community, that was a lot of concerns over the children and the pregnant women and so on. Is there going to be an effort to do that? And even just an effort to ensure that there are some gender balance men in the room. And I don't know which national survey they're making this on, that would be helpful.
So the national survey is the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, the NHE. It's conducted by the CDC as the CDC National Health Monitoring Program. Every 2 years, they collect samples and test, or actually over 150 samples are tested in blood, urine, hair of participants. But I'm sorry, I just blanked on the first part. We actually did discuss this with our advisory panel. This was because this issue was raised previously also. And their opinion was that there wasn't necessarily any scientific reason. They didn't feel that pregnant women specifically were necessarily the object for this particular project. However, they would certainly, since they are part of the population that we're sampling, they certainly would be included they'll be included at the same percentage or proportion that they are in the population because it's a random sample. They're not being excluded.
And does the department agree with the idea that there's no special risk for pregnant women?
Yes, our work group did, yes.
And who did?
Our work group, we have an external scientific work group also that prepares the proposals for the panel.
All I remember is that this congresswoman, to try to get our national organization to start including women in a lot of our studies and so on, and that took an act of Congress because most of the so-called reference bands and a lot of their studies were based on women and children were left out. And so that's why I'm raising these issues. If you wonder, I don't want to see women and children left out. And particularly considering what we're when we're talking about prenatal life and when we're talking about young children's life. As far as I understand, it's a more vulnerable time than I'm interested in the science that there's a difference. So maybe we could hear about that next time.
You mentioned something about if you worked at 3M, you maybe have had greater exposure. Is there any anecdotal evidence at least that people who worked at 3M have been exposed more and had a greater incidence of particular health situations?
I do know the answer to that, which has come basically from 3M. They have done studies of their workforce, and they have monitored employees who work most directly with these chemical compounds in the manufacturing process, and they have a number of biomonitoring projects that they've conducted on their workforce. There hasn't been any conclusion from those studies that we're aware of that suggests that there's adverse health outcomes to their workforce as a result of those exposures.
I'm a little perplexed, Mr. Stein. What is exactly, what are you trying to find out here? Just exposure? You're going to come up with a number at the end of average exposure to a somewhat randomly sampled population. And so what is the point of that? So people have been exposed and you know the average level. Then what?
Madam Chair, the person that has also been talked about quite a bit. Because these are pilot projects, the goal of these projects is again, limited, as I mentioned before, in terms of the scope. But yes, what we will learn from this is what is the average exposure. Each individual will learn their individual exposure level, but also we will learn the average exposure level in the community, in the adults. And we will be able to compare this to the average exposure levels in a national sample. That's one advantage that we have with this project, is we do have a national number to compare to. That's not true with all chemicals. So the interpretation will be simply that whether we can detect its presence there, but also how does it compare nationally? Is it about the same? Is it more than a national level? But that is the extent of what we will be able to do. Again, this is a small-scale pilot project.
I could just comment on that as well, Representative Trump, because of when the legislation was drafted and proposed, you may know that there are national programs that CDC funds through grants to other states. Minnesota has never been a recipient of any of those grant funds, has never had the opportunity to establish or conduct biomonitoring projects in this state. So this effort, as Dr. Johnson just pointed out, was to first pilot the ability of our health department to conduct these projects. The real outcome is an average exposure level as compared to national levels of exposure to these compounds. What that will do is say whether those compounds are more or less or the same present on average in this population drinking water from these water sources than a national population. Now, I also want to just take it back to a point that Dr. Johnson made, which is, were there to be more time and more funding and more resources to do more longitudinal studies when we know more specifically what could be the sources of the exposures have been, you could do more in-depth work looking at other questions that could be answered in a more longitudinal research basis.
I'm probably having difficulty hearing us. Is that one? Who's having trouble hearing you? Okay. We'll try to speak a little louder and make sure you hold this very close. Are you having trouble hearing the witnesses as well? Okay. We all need to speak up to this. All right. We want to make sure this is your hearing, so we want to make sure that it will be affected to you. Well, let me just say before we go on to the next, you know, I'm strongly supportive of my mind impression, and I do. And I represent the one who provide great leadership in bringing that bill forward to this committee to ensure that it passed. But I want to say that I'm very concerned about what I'm hearing in terms of limitations on inclusive testing because of vulnerabilities. And I am very interested in what kind of scientists are telling us that there is not special problems when we're talking about pregnant women and children. So, anyway, I'll just let it go at that. I know we have a committee that's working with you on that, and hopefully we can get some feedback on that. Is there anything else? Any other questions? Otherwise, we should have other questions.
I'm not a scientist in this area, but if you were going to, in an average sample, would you look at the average residency of people in that community and target that population? So if your average citizen lives in a community for, say, 10 years, then you would try to target people who, you know, are generally there, because the 2 years just seems that for many, there are a lot of people who have lived here for much longer. So I just throw that out as, and I'm not, you know, a researcher, but I'm just trying to look at this, maybe that might address some of the issues.
I just want, since Kathy Bonney also want to make a comment. I'm a little concerned about the issue of if we're going to go to the effort to actually collect the samples, which is a very time-consuming process, appropriate information to evaluate and, you know, determine the sample, those kinds of things, that it seems like the additional work to have a little bit more expanded questionnaire to get a better sense of how long they've been in the community, you know, what parts of the family, you know, what parts of the community, but also the additional health-related information would be a marginal added expense for the work that's already going to collect email. So I would pull people more closely at how comprehensive we've made that process. Not that this is intended to directly link to any kind of health evaluation, but it's just that even if we just collect that information now, maybe you don't have the capacity to fully, you know, evaluate at this point, that future researchers maybe will have a more expanded question to make use of that information down the line. And also if you are including pregnant women and pregnant women,
I assume I'm sure they didn't ask them. Okay, well, so I think they move on to the next
question. Thank you. I'll introduce them, perhaps, Mike Connery and Dan Wilson, both of whom work in our well management section at the Minnesota Department of Homes. Will testify about the point of use treatment site. Again, this project was to evaluate the effectiveness of treatment of a variety of different types of water treatment systems that met certain criteria. And without trying to get into that, I'm going to hand the mic to Mike Connery to just, or Dan, are you going to start? Tell me what you pay Mike into it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mike Connery, and in the well program at the Department of Health, with me is Dan Wilson, who happens to be my boss. So, but together we've been working this past 6 months on this study. The last legislature directed the Department of Health to conduct an evaluation of point-of-use treatment devices, just so that we're all on the, sort of on the same page. There is a handout that you, the members of the committee should have received. It's also on the table for any members in the audience here. But the point of use treatment device is simply a device or treatment system that's typically put on a single tap or a faucet. It simply treats the water at that source. So it doesn't treat all the water in the house. It doesn't treat the water elsewhere. These are fairly common features for all sorts of reasons. We initially sent out a proposal to independent testing laboratories this past summer, and we selected the contracting team of Water Science and Management and the Water Quality Association. The Water Quality Association is one of three major testing laboratories in the country, and is a major certification agency for water treatment devices. So we felt very confident going with that team. The study actually is in three parts, and where we are right now is at the completion of the first two stages. The very first step is we surveyed manufacturers of water treatment devices, over 500 manufacturers who have certified devices to the Water Quality Association or one of four other organizations that use certified water treatment devices, and that's listed on the second page. The Water Quality Association and NSF International and Underwriters Laboratory are the three major testing agencies in this country. They surveyed manufacturers with a very simple question: which devices do you think work or might work in dealing with removing PFCs? So we kind of threw it at them, since they obviously have the experience. Some of these companies have been thinking about this because we've been contacted by one of these companies over the past year as well, independent of the separate. They submitted approximately 36 devices. From that group, we selected 14 devices. 8 of them happened to be reverse osmosis units. 6 of them happened to be carbon units. That being said, even reverse osmosis units typically have two filters with them, not necessarily carbon. One is a pre-filter, which is largely designed to remove chlorine if the water source has chlorine. Chlorine can be kind of harsh on a reverse osmosis membrane. The post-filter is designed to polish anything that makes its way through the reverse osmosis membrane. But we submitted these 14 devices to lab testing down in at the Water Quality Association testing labs in Lyle, Illinois, just outside of Chicago. The carbon unit, there are two different ways of testing these devices, depending on whether they're reverse osmosis or a carbon treatment device. They're covered under different standards of certification. But the carbon units were treated to up to 750 gallons, typically over 150% of the rated capacity of those filters, to look for any breakthrough of PFCs. Reverse osmosis units were tested for up to 21 days as well, with rest cycles in between to try to mimic the use. These devices were challenged or hit with three different solutions to try to mimic the different situations we have in Washington County in terms of the PFC contamination, but also to hit them with very strong concentrations of this contaminant. So they basically mimic the most serious conditions that we're facing here. So one challenge solution was simply PFBA, 10 micrograms per liter. One challenge solution was PFOS and PFOA at 3 micrograms per liter each, something that we might more typically see up in the Lake Elmo area. And the third one was all three compounds at those concentrations. Again, something that we probably would typically see more of in the Lake Elmo, Oakdale area. So the single PFBA challenge solution was meant to try to deal with the situation that we're facing with generally throughout Cottage Grove, Woodbury, and the other communities in southern Washington County. Now at this point, what we have produced is, or we have received, is an interim report. I want to emphasize it is an interim report. It is based strictly on the laboratory testing. The next stage that we're just starting to go into tomorrow, actually, is to test some of these devices on real water in Washington County. So one site will be a site at one of the Oakdale municipal well houses that is dealing with all three contaminants. One site is from a St. Paul Park well house that is just dealing with the PFBA contamination. At this point, there are four reverse osmosis units that we feel very comfortable proceeding with, and those are specifically listed in the handout here. In addition, there is a fifth reverse osmosis unit that did show some breakthrough, but it also happens to be equipped with a post filter that's a collagen unit. That's the same collagen filter that was shown to be effective on its own. So at this point, we are proceeding, we're letting folks know that these four RO units, the fifth RO unit with the collagen device, and the collagen carbon unit, we feel very comfortable at this point saying that these appear to be very effective, but still have to be checked out in the field testing. In addition, there are two other reverse osmosis units and three other carbon units that did show some breakthrough in the laboratory setting. But in the case of the reverse osmosis units, the polishing filter appeared to take out any remaining PSCs that did break through. In the case of the carbon devices, they did show, again, we hit them with a fairly strong situation. So we wanted to try to mimic the normal day-to-day use of the carbon filter to see if their performance would go better. So I recognize why people might want to latch on to these, for this information that tomorrow I'm going to go out and buy one of these filters. But I think we have to realize that this is an interim stage at this point. The laboratory testing seemed to show that these units were effective, and we have five other units that may be just as effective. We're a little bit shy about announcing that because we wanted to see how these things play out in the real world. It's doing real world application. The phase two testing of the test starts tomorrow. We anticipate that it'll last about 90 days, at which point it will take a while to get the data back from our laboratory. But we're looking forward to getting results finalized by May of this survey.
Questions? First of all, I want to thank our business Wales and Bun for supporting this legislation in the House. This is one of the issues that came forward from the community of, regardless of what happens at the level, people may say, I want this out of my water, like we have water filters for many other things. And so I think this is an important study, and I want to thank the Department of Health for their work and feeling that sense of urgency. As soon as the funding was there, you really took off with it. Just to clarify, because I had a conversation today with Mr. Convery, was that when this interim report is published, it will include the filters that sort of did not pass muster with this, so that people who have a filter could say there were some filters that were not tested. Is that correct, Mr. Convery? Did I get that right?
Correct. There are 14 filters that were tested, and 11 we are proceeding with into field testing. There were three filters that at this point we felt were not worth pursuing. The performance in the last setting was a little bit short of what we would feel confident with going ahead with the field application. The report is when stages of finalizing that, so we hope to have that out on our website. All legislators will also be receiving copies of that as well.
And then you did make a lot of effort to contact a number of different filtration companies. I understand as well that you didn't just hand select these particular filters, that you made great to go out across the country and try to find a number of different filters. Is that correct?
Correct. We did contact approximately 500 companies that have devices certified with one or more of those five organizations that I mentioned. We did kind of throw it to them. If they're going to give us what devices or recommendations you would have that they think may have a chance of Google PSCs. We were a little bit surprised at first, although as we look at it more, of how much they weigh towards reverse osmosis units. Traditionally, people tend to look at carbon units as removing organic compounds, replace those cells as units that people giving things like metals or inorganic compounds. The size of the PSC molecules are such that reverse osmosis like would be actually a very good method.
Thank you again for all your work on this and staying in touch with us. I truly appreciate that. And if I might just make another comment, we do have some of our city council members here tonight. Councilmember Repples, if you would stand, and Councilmember Julianne Stevens and Mayor Hargis was here. And our city administrator is here as well, Mr. Goodley. They just had to leave, but I want to thank them for coming tonight as well. Thank you, Clint, for coming tonight.
Madam Chair, thank you. I apologize for being late. My daughter had a saxophone lesson. I had to put her both away. So I'm sorry about that. I am sitting in as a neighbor. That is my district is 55 feet. I have all Oakdale, which is very much affected by the situation that I have South Maple, which is just a mile or so away. Madam Chair, I can ask a question as well. We had a hearing, Representative Bunn, Church Committee, that has a hearing, and we talked about this somewhat. And I just want to clarify, it seems that in Oakdale that there's a problem with the PFPA breaking down the large filters. And do you see any carryover, or do you do any analysis of what's happening with the larger filtration plants, what would happen on this level, or is there anything in correlation?
Madam Chair, Representative Slaughter, I'll answer that question. We do sample the municipal water system in Oakdale on a regular basis, and our drink water engineer, Chad Colstead, works directly with the city on those results, and to correct that, PFPA has broken through the large filter system that they've constructed, and that is a concern that we've communicated to the city, and the city is working on options to remediate that. What we've learned is that the carbon filtration units that are in place PFC treatment on Oakdale's municipal water system are successfully removing contaminants of PFOA and PFOS and PFPA, but the breakthrough is rather short time frame compared to what was expected for PFOA and PFOS. So the breakthrough on the filters now, those filters have been in, the filtration system has been in place since November of 2006. So they've been successfully treating the water for about 14 months for PFOA and PFOS, but there hasn't been very good PFPA through their system. And we're working with the city on that.
So you would work here to
kind of
expose the chair and change or reverse
the
osmosis, or have it stronger
or
replaced, or it would be some kind of...
Alternate strategies might include looking for an alternate source of water to eliminate the use of the water that's got PFPA in it, because at the scale that they're pumping, reverse osmosis would produce a significant amount of wastewater. A reverse osmosis unit requires uses about three times the amount of water that it actually treats, because the membrane is passing water, rejecting some of the contaminants that's then flushed away by the water that passes by. And so that's about a 3-to-1 ratio. That would produce a significant amount of wastewater in a municipal pump house. And so reverse osmosis is the only tool of last resort in larger systems like that. And the real solution that we are aware that the city is working on is an alternate source of water. It would be lower in concentration of PFPA or free of PFPA.
The question I had was, my understanding of this breakthrough is that carbon filtration can work at a large scale of the field, but it lasts a lot less long than you expect relative to something chemical. And in general, that's true of PFE. I noticed in the document you prepared on the water filter study results that it doesn't give, if that's what's going to be posted or similar to that for the consumer in the next few weeks, it doesn't really give the consumer or resident a sense about how long last in place. Is that information something that you provided in the next month, or will it be day two?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a good question. We do have information about the manufacturer's recommendations on maintenance and replacement of the membrane, if it's a reverse osmosis unit, or the filter itself, if it's a carbon filter, or if there's a combination between
a membrane and a filter. There are manufacturer's recommendations which we will incorporate into our materials that we'll make available to the public so that people know what manufacturer's specifications are. Following those will probably be the best advice in terms of ongoing maintenance of the system. But the way we designed the sample, the testing was to look at an average household use and actually, as Mike mentioned, challenge the system with a little bit higher volume in some cases.
This is my understanding, at least up to this point, prior to the keep being part of it, most of the manufacturers constructed changing filters with space and other kinds of pollutants, which have a much longer tank replacement than TFDA would. So I'm more concerned that we would be relying on manufacturers for that. Unless they're updating their specifications to portray what's more important to the household.
Yeah, that's, I'm going to let Mike comment on it as well, but we did challenge the filters with, and the units with, what would be the equivalent of annual water use, the annual household water use. So the fact that we're identifying the successful filters would be, at least for over the course of the year, they would be successful.
Sir, when we set the criteria for even selecting devices, one of the criteria that we're looking at is to try to choose a point-of-use device that would treat at least, or is ready to treat at least 500 gallons. You're correct saying that those criteria really are not based on POC, really no one has looked at that. We're looking at other kinds of contaminants, other kinds of organic contaminants. But when we were challenging the carbon filters, when we were challenging them, we challenged them to 150%, you know, 1.5 times their rated capacity, because wanted to see what their performance was beyond their rated capacity. And for instance, the one carbon filter that we felt very comfortable with was not showing a breakthrough at 150%.
That this meeting was happening tonight. And I had a teacher come up to me and say, and this is a common concern, we didn't cause the contamination, why did we have to pay for this? And you are doing exactly what the legislation asked for, but there is a frustration in the community that there are people who just, they're concerned about this, but they don't necessarily feel like they should be the ones responsible for providing the filtration system. When we first talked about all of this, before this legislation passed, we were asking a lot of questions in hearings about what can we do for city wells that could do the same kind of thing. What I'm hearing from you right now is not practical, it's not affordable, it's science is great, we got to figure it out. Money from the kids here are tonight who are part of science classes are going to be talking about labs, so their kids are great. But it's frustrating to consumers and the homeowners and the people who are concerned about the health of their hands. So I guess what I'm asking is what kind of guarantees can you make to us, or not guarantees, but at least a statement of confidence that this testing would remove enough of the chemicals from our water that people would be safe about it? And is there discussion, and I don't know if there is, at least in the House, about how this could be provided, or if there are grants, or if there are, you know, some sort of thing that we can provide assistance so that they might be able to have access to these filtration systems?
Madam Chair, Representative Swales, I'll answer the second question. I'm going to ask Mike to answer the first part of the question. Confidence in the results. You asked about our confidence in the testing results. Let me just answer that question. The second question is, you're absolutely right that, and we were in the community about a year ago in February last year, talking with community members about what we had learned. And you're right about, public sense of equity and who should pay it? I'm not in a position to answer that question. However, we have been in constant communication with the communities, with community leaders, about remediation of the sites that are the source of these contaminants in the groundwater. The Municipal Pollution Control Agency has the lead responsibility for that. So I think, you know, just again, stepping back for a second, the first challenge is if we're going to do something about the water, let's do our best to determine that we've eliminated sources of future contamination. And the Municipal Pollution Control Agency is working hard to do that. Secondly, the agreement that they reached with 3M Company has done a significant amount of good in terms of identifying possible strategies to remediate those sites and address future risks. I'm aware that the communities are working closely with us, with the Pollution Control Agency, and with 3M on those strategies that might be used to treat drinking water or to look for alternate sources of drinking water in the future, but those questions are quite a ways away from being answered in the sense of what's feasible. And so, your comment about how we might look at cost-sharing programs, other things, there hasn't been anything from a state agency perspective that we've formally put forward at this point in time, but we're very interested in the solutions that might be arrived at. I think the most of the drinking water engineers that we consult with would say, in terms of drinking water, alternate sources that are free of those chemicals would be the cheapest solution. Anything where you have treat water at a scale we're talking about for municipal water supplies is going to be very costly and very challenging to implement. However, for those persons who own private wells, some of these filtration devices, other treatment strategies may be more cost effective. Then the question of equity, that's not a question we can directly address. I'll ask Mike to talk about the other question.
As I indicated, the phase one part of the study is really a screening tool. I think by May of this spring, we may have up to 11 different devices out there that we would have. May have, we would have some confidence that they indeed would be effective in treating and removing PFCs. And PFBA is the most difficult of the three, particularly for carbon. Does that mean those are the only devices that will work? No. There are other devices that basically work the same way. I think as there are more laboratories that develop the ability to test for PFCs, and as groups like the Water Quality Association or NSF International look at certifying treatment devices, PFC is not unique to Minnesota. There are a number of other states that deal with the very same issues. There is interest in PFC treatment, both plant use as well as on a much larger scale. So I think over time you'll see more and more treatment devices that are certified to remove PFC compounds. This is not unlike the situation we were dealing with volatile organic chemicals 20 years ago. Compounds you see in solvents or petroleum products, they were showing up in municipal wells in St. Anthony and New Brighton and other communities around the state. We were faced with a very similar situation, but over time the industry, both the point of use treatment industry as well as much larger scale treatment systems evolved and a whole industry development that were certified to remove those kinds of contaminants. So I anticipate the same development will eventually occur with PFCs over time.
Madam Chair, Representative Swale, I'd like to just add a little bit more in terms of the confidence. Basically, phase one tested three units of each type. So now we've got data on three units. Phase two is going to take the same units, different, of course, new boxes. Test some more. So we will have replicated information on those units. In addition to testing individual units, we have to keep in mind we're also testing two technologies. We're testing carbon, we're testing reverse osmosis. What we're finding out is that through a number of manufacturers, we're seeing these two technologies again and again produce. So that adds to the confidence level. So as the data improves and increases, and I should emphasize, this is the beginning of our information on these treatment devices. This won't be the end of it. We will continue to get more information. Oh, yes. John Stein just mentioned that in support of this study, the actual analysis of the water was conducted by our state laboratory, which is one of only a handful of laboratories in the entire country that are qualified to do the testing. So we're very confident in the numbers that were generated. And again, as we get information on replicate more and more of these units, it does build a body of information that we're fairly confident that what these things are doing, they will continue to do.
I think I'd be remiss if I didn't comment on the statement about the department not being willing to address the equity issue. This is the Department of Public Health. And this department is capable of making recommendations to the governor and to the legislature. And so I'm going to challenge you to think about the equity issue, how people will be able to pay for these filters and not be able to pay for these filters. And I will look forward to some recommendations. And I know they have to go through the governor to get to us. And the governor can say, no, we're not going to do this. But I really would ask you to think about that question, because I know that there are people that have come up with, you know, in the last year, how are we going to pay for these people? Because there are people who can't pay for them. And also, if they deteriorate and need to be replaced, how will they be able to track that? So I just want to offer that challenge. This is the finance committee, so we're the committee that should be able to come up with the dollars. There'll be some of the dollars. There are the committees that also deal with that.
Yes, you mentioned that for larger commercial applications of the reverse osmosis, you use much more water. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes.
Is that true on the small household?
Yes.
Boy, you know, I have two wells, and I would be really hesitant about taking the reverse osmosis systems on my two household taps if I thought they were going to dump out that much more water. I mean, and I would get that if I was a water management person in one of these communities, I'd be worried about that too. Your water usage would go up pretty dramatically if 50% of your people applied reverse osmosis.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumper, again, because we're looking at a point of use unit, we're actually looking at treating like too many 3 gallons of water a day producing that much. We're figuring probably a half a gallon of drinking water per day per person. That's calculated. So it wouldn't be the whole house. So if you're generating 2 to 3 gallons of drinking water a day, then you'd be generating 3 to 9 gallons of wastewater. And of course, it's all going into the waste stream anyway, so it really just separates the supply and then ends up in the waste stream. But in terms of the waste, generally the technology, one pass through the membrane will generate 3 gallons of wastewater for every gallon of treated water. There are engineering applications for large systems that can reconcentrate that. So we would not out of hand rule out the possibility that large applications could be engineered. But what they'll do is they'll take the wastewater, they'll run it through another membrane, concentrate it some more, and they can reduce the waste stream, but as John Stein indicated, it's still going to be many, many gallons of water that's treated on our floor.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll ask Dr. Helen Gaines to join me to say that Dr. Gaines is our lead risk assessor, who has spent, I think, the vast majority of the past 2.5 years of her life evaluating the scientific information about these compounds. So we are here to have Dr. Gaines provide us an update on our progress towards setting a health-based value for the FDA.
Thank you. If it's comfortable, I'd like to kind of give you an overview of activities for other PFCs as well as lower PFCA. Actually, tomorrow is the deadline for the health risk limits for PFC report to the legislature. It is the deadline for the final report, and that will be delivered tomorrow and hopefully shortly later this week. That will also be posted on our website, on the PFC homepage, on our at the MDH website. In that report, we talk about how staff at the agency keep abreast of the research that's going on these chemicals. And we do that by actually discussing ongoing research with the individuals who actually conduct the research, whether that's at EPA or at 3M or academic institutions. We are also in frequent contact with other health and environmental agencies, either at the state level or federal level, who are dealing with the risk assessment issues for these chemicals as well. And when possible, we attend scientific meetings where these issues are also presented. And in fact, I just wanted to mention that this last fall, so circa 2007, we organized a couple of different sessions for some of the scientific meetings that we attended. One was in North Carolina, where Research Triangle Park is located, and there's a very large EPA laboratory there that's conducting a lot of PFC research. So we took the opportunity to put together a session and invited the scientists to come to the scientific meeting and present. We also presented at the same session. Through all of this interaction, what we've learned is that there are really no new studies on people on PFAS that are really better than what we selected to develop our health risk limits and health-based values on. In addition to that, we've also learned that blood levels are a better measure than administered dose, which is what our current value is based on administered dose. So in our dual reevaluation that we're currently in our dual promulgation process, we have looked at using the blood level as the measure by which to extrapolate to humans in terms of toxicity. So just to sort of remind people that our current health risk limits for people on PFAS were promulgated through the good cause exemption process this summer as a result of legislation, and those values were promulgated on August 27th. Now, through the rule process that's undergoing, we've also put out recently draft health risk limit values that are slightly different for PFOA than they are the current promulgated values. I just want to stress that these are draft values that are out for public review as part of the rule process, so they are not new standards. The standards that were promulgated in August are still new standards. And once the new rule is revised and promulgated, that draft values are still in place, they would become the new standards, but not until they're actually promulgated. And for PFOS, the draft value is still 0.3 micrograms per liter, and PFOA has the current value that was promulgated in August is 0.5, the draft value is 0.3. And the only thing that's really changed in the methodology is the use of the blood levels rather than administered dose. Now, for PFBA, we are currently reviewing all of the submitted toxicity data. We have, at the oversight hearing in December, Representative Bundy requested that we post the 28-day and 90-day study reports. Those have been posted on our website. And we are also reviewing the results of the request data analysis that we made to 3M as well. In addition to looking at the data, a large part of the effort is in data interpretation. What does the data tell us? And we have been in consultation with EPA scientists who are experts in the area of endocrinology, since one of the sensitive endpoints in these studies has been changes in thyroid hormone measures. We are also in the process of arranging for a review by Dr. Marash, who heads the Division of Endocrinology and Diabetes at the University of Minnesota. We're hoping to get together sort of a review package for him this week, actually. He's just recently agreed to do that review for us. And we're also still discussing whether or not there's additional reviews to be considered as well. I believe that's the December oversight meeting. John's committed to having a number out by February, and at this point, that is still our plan to do that.
During February.
Within the month of February, we'll have a number. That is my comments in terms of an overview. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Thank you for the update. And we did hear in December. My question to you is, obviously,
sub level, what happens when a well tests above level or a city water supply tests above level? When do we take that step? Or I don't want to be premature, but obviously once you set something and it becomes the rule, and then, you know, certain states like Wisconsin, if they have levels exceeding, I think it's been interesting, then those areas get special treatment and certain things that go into action based on being above the levels. Have you
yes.
Spelled that out, what's going to happen?
Madam Chair, Representative Slavik, the standard procedure for our agency is, first of all, once there's a level that's been established either by formal review and the publication of a health-based value, which is a technical decision made by the Department of Health. We then notify our drinking water program staff of that level, and we begin, if there are exceedances of those values, to work with individual well owners by giving them advice how they should consume the water, not consume the water. In this case, in Washington County, where there are contaminated or disposal sites or an abandoned landfill, in this case the Washington County closed landfill, we would notify the Pollution Control Agency, who has a role and responsibility in assisting in the determination of how to deal with that exceedance. We work with the responsible parties where there's a disposal site subject to the state Superfund law. So, yeah, there's a process that engages. Once we learn that there's an exceedance, there's action taken to reduce the exposure, either by working with the individual well owners or with the responsible parties in the public water system. That is, in fact, what happened in Lake Elmo when they had exceedances of our health-based values for PFOA and PFOS. As soon as those exceedances occurred, we notified all parties involved, and a solution was designed. Meaning an alternate water source. And that will happen again when a value is set for PFBA. If there are exceedances of that value, it will trigger response in terms of advice to private well owners or modification of municipal water systems that exceed that value if that exists.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider. I'm thinking the legislators would be in the loop of kind of what's happening in terms of when those exceedances happen and how many residents that covers and if you're doing bottled water. And because, there are constituents, and we're concerned about if there are exceedances, and that's why you set health risk limits to have a base of and then to know what to do when it goes above that. So it's, you know, all of it is the right way to go. It's just, we obviously, if it goes above that, want to have a plan to get greener and fast. Is there a time limit on that, how quickly things would happen?
There's not a specific time frame. I can say that, it depends on the solution to be designed. In this case, however, since the sources of the contamination are relatively well understood, we have been through that process. We know that the Pollution Control Agency is queued up to provide alternate drinking water if that's needed on a private well, and that's been happening. If it's a municipal system, we know that the municipal engineers, as well as engineers from DAM and our department, are already working together on possible solutions that may be feasible to address any exceedances. So we're doing all the pre-work we can about PFBA to be ready for what should we do to address any exceedances.
And the date on that, then, when we have the level of use at February?
During February.
Thank you.
Another question on HDV, the health-based values, and HRL. When our city publishes a report on water quality, are there chemicals that are listed that also have either an HDV or an HRL in that report? Can you imagine? I don't have that report in front of me, but when you see the report that comes out, there's a number of things in our water that we would prefer not to be there, but do some of those compounds have HDVs or HRLs?
Madam Chair, Senator Salzman, yes, they have what's called an MCL. They're required to report on exceedances of the maximum contaminant limits. That is a federal term used in the Safe Drinking Water Act. Many of those MCLs match up or are the subject of our health-based values or health risk limits as well. They don't always match in values, but in terms of drinking water advice, what we utilize is NARM. According to the last year's legislation, we're using the lower of the two.
So this is your question. When we talk about equity with water filters, there are already compounds in our water, but because they're under the HDV or the HRL we're referring to tonight, they're not a cause for mandatory filtration. So when we look at, I think what we're most interested here is finding what that value is going to be for PFDA. And if it's above that, you know, that I think is was my intent with the water filter study was that I was concerned about consumer issues with people selling, you know, filtration systems with claims. All of us received many of these flyers. And not knowing if they truly were able to remove the PFDA, but there's already compounds in our water that some of us buy filters for to remove. So I guess I just want to raise that issue that we certainly want to be able to offer that. And should this be set and PFDA is above that, I think that's when there will be greater urgency in finding filtration for those people who are above those particular levels.
That's correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a scientific background, so you're going to have to put in a little bit more understandable language for me. When you describe the multi studies, now you're talking about micrograms instead of parts per billion. And I was just beginning to understand parts per billion, and this is a whole new mechanism for me. We were talking about, we had one part per billion in the PFPA in our water, but that we felt that was a safe level. Now you're talking about 0.3 micrograms. So how does that translate?
Oh, my apologies. I know last time I made sure I said parts per billion all the way through. Micrograms per liter is the same as parts per million.
I have a couple questions. One of the things I think about the kind of study that you're doing here is short term. You talk about 28 days and you talk about 90 days. Really, that was the short term of anybody's life, the community. So, what are we doing to understand, and is this PFDA in any way going to start looking at more chronic long-term exposure, because it seems to me, again, it's just children who are beginning, 3 years, the 3-year-old is a lifetime, you know, people who live here 10 years, 20 years, whatever. I'm just trying to understand what we're going to, do you intend in any way to try to look at longer-term exposure, maybe in the request from the legislature, we did spell it out carefully, we need to. I guess I'm wondering, because it seems to me like what I've learned about other toxic exposures, sometimes a very small amount for a short period of time may not appear to have a big effect, but that very small amount over a period of time is moderate and has a very serious effect. So how are you approaching that? How do you intend to approach that?
Madam Chairman, the number of days one has to keep in mind that these studies are being done on laboratory rodents. So a 90-day study for a laboratory rodent is almost 10% of their lifetime. So it is a longer period of time than perhaps on the surface of thinking of it as 90 days. One of the reasons we have 3M conduct studies for a variety of periods of time is there's a 5-day study, and then there's a 28-day study, and then subsequently a 90-day study. That's the very reason that you mentioned is why we have to do longer and longer durations to see if indeed the doses that elicit effect decrease. The effect that, you know, the very most sensitive effect, the longer you expose the animals, that effective level gets lower and lower.
We did not observe that for this chemical. And in part, that could be in due in part to the very short half-life of this particular chemical. Whereas for PFOA and PFOS, it does accumulate slowly over time, and therefore that was more of a concern. At this point, given the information we have, since it does not look like longer duration than lipids, a lower effective dose level, we tentatively have no intention at this point to make an adjustment for that. If there was evidence that that happens, we would make an adjustment for the fact that the longer the exposure continues, the lower the effective level becomes. But we did not observe that in the serial studies that were conducted. And although I only really talked about the 28-day and 90-day studies, there is a developmental study that was performed by the US EPA as well. So development was at least a particular endpoint that were evaluated for PFOA.
Was that one study done by EPA? Are there more that we can look at?
The one study conducted, and they did three different separate flocks of animals to replicate their results. But there is only one investigation that's been conducted by EPA.
And what about the issue of cumulative or multiple exposures? So a family who is not only getting his PFAs, we're trying to understand what the danger is, but they're also having the other PFCs, and they're also having lead, or they're also having mercury, they're also having other kinds of toxic exposures in their water, their food. Is there any way that we're trying to look at that in healthcare, maybe not in this study, but is that something that we're interested in?
Madam Chairman, actually in the existing rule and this will continue in the revised rule, there is a requirement that if you have multiple chemicals present and they affect the same health effect, you must evaluate the mixture of those chemicals and consider that. So for these particular chemicals, for example, the liver is a very sensitive organ and it's a common health endpoint for all of the PFCs. And therefore, chemicals that do have either a health risk limit or health-based value are looked at in an additive manner, that they would, their effects will be additive. So they're looked at in the mixture. So we specifically do require that under the rule. Now, if there is a question regarding actual experimental data in laboratory animals, know that those studies have not been conducted.
If they haven't been conducted, how are you able to evaluate? You just said you have to try to evaluate them. What's the gap there?
Madam Chairman, the approach of looking at additive effect has been based on other chemicals and what we see at low levels, and it's self-evident to protective measures. There are other options that one can do that would be higher or lower levels of protection. It's the standard for risk assessment methodology for addressing multiple chemicals exposure.
Okay, just one last question. You mentioned that there might be alternative water sources that would be considered. I don't know if you were talking about. Can you tell me what alternative water sources we're talking about?
Yes, I'm sure. It could be from a different aquifer, a different location of the same aquifer, up gradient of contamination sources. In all of these communities, the geology, hydrogeology, will determine the degree to which flows of contaminants move from point A to point B, and we're sensitive to the fact that when you put in a new pumping point, you can alter the direction of flow and the pathways of flow. So, by and large, alternate sources of water would be locations that are free of PFBA in the aquifers. So either a deeper aquifer or a different location of a shallower aquifer that would be free from those sources.
And are we also talking about bottled water?
In the event that there's a limit exceeded, yes, bottled water is provided in a number of homes at the present time as a short-term solution to address an alternate water source. Ultimately, though, alternate approaches to providing a long-term water supply would be more prudent than bottled water.
And what's the
return
of bottled water for this business?
Well, that's a good question, Madam Chair. I'm not sure that I can answer that question. Carla or Jim, do you know? Come on down.
Yeah, I'm not sure. to Madam Chair. Carl Peterson, I'm an engineer with the Minnesota Department of Health. And a lot of bottle wine you see in the grocery store, it's usually reverse osmosis treated. That tends to capture any contaminants of concern. So most wine that would be available would, of course, be treated with RO, reverse osmosis.
Yeah, sure. I augment that. I know that the bottled water that was provided by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency was sampled and tested for all PFCs and the standard suite of drinking water contaminants that's required under the Safe Drinking Water Act. So in this case, where bottled water is provided, the water has been tested and meets all the Safe Drinking Water Act requirements and is free of PFCs. The state does not have a program of funding. I just want to be clear, Carla, we do not have a program of testing bottled water or providing results to the public on that.
I think that's an important clarification. And I have actually looked at a lot of bottled water, and it isn't all that because I'm going to vote. It's a pure natural right from the spring, and there's nothing else done to it. So I guess it's just something I think the public needs to be aware of. Did you want to ask anything?
Department has been talking about additional research being done, a developmental study and opposed to not cleaning study. And correct me if I'm wrong, the development study means it is on the pregnant rodents and the offspring, so it is looking to see the development of the babies.
Welcome to the committee, and we're going to be hearing about this pollution choice and disease.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Baker. I'm the Director of Mediation with the Division of Pollution Control Agency. And with me, I also have Doug Weststein. He's the supervisor of the Superfund program. His group is responsible for the sites that are under the consent order, which is the Oak Hill, Woodbury, and Cottage Grove. And then also, I have with me Jeff Lewis, who's the manager of our flow management program, and that's the program that's responsible for the Washington County landfill and Lake Elmo. I'm going to provide you an update on the work that we've been doing over the past year on these four PFC contaminated sites. First of all, I'm going to start out with the three sites that are under the consent order that was negotiated with 3M. And was executed by the NCACA Citizens Board on May 22, 2007. The consent order addresses investigation and response activities at the 3M disposal sites, which were located at Oakdale, Woodbury, and Cottage Grove. Overall, I want to say that cooperation with 3M has been going very well, and we continue to be satisfied with the progress that's being made under the consent order. The consent order has various requirements for each of the three sites, and I'm going to briefly talk about kind of where we're at with that process. Remedial investigation is complete or in progress for all three sites. Feasibility studies are underway. Basically, the feasibility studies are taking a look at the alternatives that could be pursued for cleanup actions at the site. And just wanted to also let you know that under the consent order, primacy is being given to excavation of contaminated materials. And this remediation standard is significantly more stringent than we would normally require under other cleanup sites. The feasibility studies are underway, and 3M has already conducted public information meetings at Oakdale in December, Woodbury last week, and Cottage Grove is scheduled for January 31st. At these meetings, they're presenting the alternatives that are being considered for each of the sites, and then also seeking public input. Once the feasibility studies are submitted to the Pollution Control Agency, we also will be reviewing the feasibility studies and looking at proposed alternatives to move forward with. We will also be providing public information meetings and 30-day public input time at that time also. Final decision as far as how we move forward will be made by the Commission of Pollution Control Agency. Also want to let you know other work that we're doing on those sites is we've requested additional work of 8 monitoring wells to be placed in Cottage Grove and Woodbury, various locations that we can identify where the gaps are and information as far as where those plumes are. And then also just kind of follow up on the previous conversation is under the consent charter, we do have a commitment with 3M that once HPV or HRL is established with PSVSPA, that they are committed to follow up with alternative drinking services for those areas. Next, I'm going to talk about the Washington County Landfill, and this site is under the Cold Landfill Program of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, so it's being managed by the state. Currently, we had a contractor that took a look at evaluating 6 alternatives for the site. Those 6 alternatives were presented to the neighborhoods that were surrounding the Washington County Landfill and also the City Council in meetings last week to seek their initial input. For that site also, we will be, PCA will be holding a public information meeting and also have a 30-day comment period on what alternatives to move forward on. What I also want to mention about this site is that although 3M wasn't obligated to, they did contribute in the consent card up to $8 million to be used through legal action at this site. The agency has also requested $15 million from the legislature, and that is something that is currently in the governor's recommendation that came out today as far as being able to be available to move forward with cleaning up that site. In the meantime, for the community in Lake Elmo, affected by the Washington Landfill, we are providing bottled water or gas systems for those that still are not hooked up to municipal systems, so their water is being taken care of. Basically, in summary, I'd like to say that settlement agreement and consent order actions and requirements are continuing to move forward as desired. Feasibility studies are on schedule. We'll have opportunity for public comment at the MPCA meetings and 30 days for people to provide that comment, and that will be taken into account before we make our final alternative selection, which ultimately will be made by the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. And hopefully we will be able to implement response actions yet this year. And just overall, the agency is continuing to provide quarterly updates to our board as far as the progress of the consent order, and then also what's going on with all 4 sites. To the PSC Oversight Group of the East Temporary. With that, I'll open up to questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you could clarify a few things, perhaps. There was a presentation on Thursday night regarding the Woodbury disposal site. And so I think everybody from Woodbury goes there thinking this is the source of the contamination, and yet it is the Washington County site in Lake Elmo that we believe is what is sending the PFBAs south. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, what we believe is that the contamination in Woodbury is coming from the north and is from a combination of the Oakdale and the Washington County landfill site.
So that's why it's so important for us to have that site cleaned up. And I just want to also wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the closed landfill program, because when the Senate Bonding Committee was up there, they did a very good job, because you know, even today I was with a House member and we were talking about the governor's bonding bill that includes the $15 million for the site. And I believe that there's even a note that 3M has been going to contribute the $8 million. And she said, well, why isn't 3M clean up the whole thing? And I said, well, actually, you know, they've come forward with the $8 million because it's a closed program, and there were other businesses that use that site. So could you just maybe explain a little bit more about that? I think that's important for the public to understand that 3M is coming to the table to help with this, and they're under no obligation to do that.
Thank you. I'll let Jeff Lewis respond to that.
Senator Schultzman, the Cold Landfill Program was established in 1994 by the Minnesota Legislature as an alternative to the federal Superfund program, a number of the major landfills that were closed about that period of time were in the process of getting tied up in a lot of different since the Superfund program, and this closed landfill program was set up as an alternative where instead of fighting about who is the responsible party for all the contamination that occurs, there was legislation passed, funding sources established, and it was a decision of the state to take care of these sites as a collective need rather than trying to fight about who the ERP is at a particular site. This is a little bit unique because the compound that we're talking about here can be traced back to one group, but it's still an alternative to Superfund that we use effectively at a lot of different sites, and based on the statutes that were passed in 94, 3M had no responsibility to come forward with the money for cleaning up the site.
A question just about your comments. Now, I'm kind of behind on this because I don't sit on this committee and represent the Clinton Committee just kind of kicked in. But your comment about excavation, the long term vision is by excavating and getting all of it out, right? The water supply should be cleaned up because there's no more going down into the aquifers, right? Is that the reason? So, all of, when you say excavation, the idea to get out of all contaminants from the current these landfills, is that possible?
Madam Chair, I'm I'll start out with the mechanism we have set up saying that we do. I think basically what we're looking at is the fact that where we can, we're going to try to excavate whatever we can out of the soil. And then that's my understanding, at least with the two alternatives that we've heard so far for Oakdale and Woodbury, this could be a combination of excavate what material they can, and then whatever's left in the groundwater system, that there'll be pumping tree systems that will take care of the ongoing problem.
I might just add that I think it was briefly touched on that at several of these sites, there were actions taken by 3M back quite a number of years ago, which, at least in the case of Oakdale, did involve excavation as well as the implementation of a groundwater barrier system. Undoubtedly, a fair amount of PFCs were removed at that time. No one would have known that, but they were removed. Certainly, further source removal is the way to go, and they have identified an area in the Oakdale disposal site that needs some additional work. That same activity is going on at the other two locations where they've gone back out specifically to look for hot spots, and as Kathy indicated, the consent order requires a primacy for excavation. I think John even mentioned that removal of the source is a preferred option. Get the source out of there, but you still have residual. You'll never get it all. And there'll be contaminants that remain in the ground, in low levels in various places, as well as in the groundwater. And that's why at each of these sites, there's a groundwater barrier system that's not only in place, but in some cases will be enhanced to deal effectively with that remaining contamination.
This map we have here, could you just explain to me why at the very top the Washington County landfill is the source and the red is down here underneath the Woodbury disposal site. I understand your flow.
Okay.
Do the audience have this done? I think it was a copy solution.
Those are based upon the well sampling that's been taking place. I think it includes municipal wells, non-community wells, private wells, and I believe it's specifically PFBA in South Washington County. The various shades, the colors, correspond to the levels of contaminants that have been found in those well samples. And what you're seeing is areas of non-detect as well as gradation then on and up to areas where there were samples found to be greater than 2 parts per million, which would be the red. And there should be a separate map for, I believe, 3 different aquifers, if it's the ones that I'm thinking of.
Can I just
The map that you're showing is probably a health department map, so I don't feel good about making these folks answer the question. It's a map that shows the contaminants found in wells. It is not a plume map. Okay, so those would be different maps than what you're looking at. And the Pollution Control Agency has maps that would be more typically viewed as plume maps, subject to specific sources and the likely plume that came from those sources of contamination. Perhaps that's the confusion about what you're looking at. You're not looking at plume map. You're looking at, these are the concentrations that we found in specific wells across the area, but they're not intended to describe plumes.
You speak of plume, does say here, approximate boundary of northern plumes. And the, again, the red that I see here, the 2 parts per million per billion, is down below that. So, and it's just confusing to me as to why the Washington landfill is the source of the most of it when the well is tested so high below that.
I think one of the questions I see there is on the map, the 3M Woodbury disposal site is right at the point where that high level begins, so maybe it's probably a question. And I guess the question might be, what do we know about that in the source?
Well, I could talk maybe about the north, what we refer to as the north plume first, and then we'll come back to this Woodbury site. I think as has been indicated, we believe that there have been releases over time. Those releases most likely occurred well before any of the remediation activities that took place, even back in the mid-70s or early 80s. PFDA moves very quickly in the groundwater, PFOA and PFOS not as fast. The Oakdale release and the Washington County releases at some point commingle as it moved south. One thing we do know from a lot of the well sampling that we've done, the monitoring we've done, is that when we've gone back and tested some of these same wells repeatedly, we find that the concentrations are very stable. It's not changing. We think that's a good thing, but we're not sure exactly what that means. Obviously, a lot of pumping activity has increased over time with municipal wells, private wells, moving into this area as it's developed. It pulls groundwater around as well as the natural flow directions. Clearly the PFBA has moved further, farther, as opposed to the other two contaminants from the north. Now, when you look at the Woodbury disposal site, we have a area of PFOA that does show up in Cottage Grove. It's a rather narrow band. We don't know when that material escaped that site, but it is the only PFOA that we have found to date in that part of Washington County. Otherwise, it's been PFDA primarily. And again, it's widespread, for the most part, low level.
We want to make sure that there's a chance for you all to ask questions and comments. I just wanted to make one, emphasize one of the points that was made and this is in regards to the comment that you made, Senator. The thing that's unique here is that there is only one source of this particular this chemical. We don't have a concern of like who's the responsible party. We know who's the responsible party. I was talking with Representative Wiggins today about why this law was changed in 94. And my understanding at that time was that there were leaking landfills all over not getting fixed. And so there was a concern, let's go ahead and try to, take some role out of the government to try to clean this up, poison the waters. And at that time, 3M did support that. And at that time, we knew nothing about these contaminants coming from 3M. So I just want to put that out there. This is going to be a taxpayer-funded project for the most part, one-third by 3M, but it all came from that source. And I just think it's important to keep that in perspective because everybody's going to be paying for this. Let's hear from any of you who might have comments, questions, and feel free to. I want to thank you, MPCA, for coming tonight. Any comments or questions you can do in your seat and feel if you're more comfortable there. We'll bring that up. Probably might have to come down here. Sir, could you come down here? We can hear you. Maybe just go ahead and if you didn't use yourself, you see that for the record.
When you did the study with the reverse osmosis unit and starting off with 10 micrograms per liter, and after the processing, what did the final concentration come down to?
The reason we're asking is that we take these sessions for posterity and we want to know who's speaking it. So, sir, could you just introduce yourself, please?
My name is Nirmal Bhattacharya. I'm with the Woodbury.
Again, I'm Mike Conway with the Physical Department Health Oil Program. The detection limits of these compounds are typically down on 0.2 microgram per liter range or part per billion range. And that's what we were looking at breakthroughs. So if we were able to detect POCs above those detection limits, that's what we were looking at. So if we were saying that reverse osmosis did not show any breakthrough, it meant that we didn't see any detection coming out the sort of the other side of it.
The detection level from analytical techniques is just 0.2
micrograms. Correct, generally. I mean, it can vary slightly from run to run depending on the lab conditions. But in general, that's the kind of range that we're normally talking about detection is for POCs.
Any comments, questions
before
we're going to stay here until 8?
Hi, my name is Kim Carlson. I'm a Woodbury resident. I'm pregnant, and I've lived here for about 35 years, which means I've been through UTSDA for 35 years, decidedly more than 10% of my life. So my question is mainly to the Department of Health and to the legislature as well. How can you honestly tell me that it's safe for me to drink TFDA, especially for the rest of my life? That's what you're suggesting as well, even at low levels. And how can you tell me it's safe for my for my unborn child. According to the only three studies, I believe, that have been done on the chemical, I want to know what other studies are proposed. What are they on? I mean, aside from the rat, you know, how does the rat compare to a human? Basically, I feel like I am the study, and I'm not comfortable with that. Also, meeting in last spring, a member of the Department of Health actually said on record to the audience that she did not recommend pregnant women drink the water. And then I never heard about that again. So I'm hearing a lot of different information and it's based on very limited study, and I'd like to comment on that.
Thank you.
Very, very good question and relevant to what we are concerned about, which is long-term exposure. As well as developmental effects. Having said that, there is very, very little research that has been done. So what we're giving you now is our best available scientific review of what we know to have occurred in laboratory animals. Longer term studies would be of value, looking at different species of laboratory animals to evaluate any kind of health effects or consequences on critical endpoints in those laboratory animals. Those studies would take some time to design and conduct, and that would be the normal course of action in this scientific endeavor, which is it will take time to design and conduct additional studies. The Department of Health will provide advice about future studies, but we do not conduct those studies. We recommend studies to academics and to the corporations that produce the chemicals and try to work with the legislature to best inform the public about risk. Additionally, the sensitivity that was expressed last year around pregnant women, should you, shouldn't you drink the water, we were at a point in time when there was virtually no information relevant to this compound and its half-life in your body. The fact that the compound is short-lived in terms of half-life is significant and will inform future research that's conducted, but we would value additional studies in the future, and we don't expect to stop asking for them.
Can I just make a comment just to add to this question? Are we also talking about the timing of the exposure, not just the quantity of the exposure?
Yes, in a scientific evaluation world, it would be beneficial to look at a variety of research questions around timing, dose, and try to evaluate a variety of factors. It is, again, part of the scientific community's charge to look at the most relevant questions first, and we're, by doing these studies that we have done, we've started on the path that is prudent and normal for evaluating risk in human beings through laboratory animal studies. Additional studies of biomonitoring studies of people and of subpopulations that may be exposed could be greatly beneficial as well.
Do you have any other questions from the audience? Comments?
Dave Cardinal from Woodbury, and in regards to the filtration of the water, is it just for drinking or is it for baths, dishes, cooking? Does that need to be filtered also? That type of thing, or?
I'm Jim Elliott with the Minnesota Department of Health, and that's actually an excellent question, and one we get fairly frequently. What we've learned about PFCs based on their physical and chemical properties is that when it comes to human exposure, the pathway that we're really primarily concerned about is consumption of the water. Because of the way the chemicals behave, they don't absorb real readily through your skin, and they don't evaporate from the water. Some contaminants do, volatile organic compounds that Mike described earlier are set of chemicals that evaporate from water, so we don't become concerned about showering, bathing, and so forth. But with PFCs, fortunately, they're very soluble in water. They're very big molecules that don't want to come out of the water, so we're chiefly concerned with consumption, which is why reverse osmosis is one of the treatment methods that we've seen as effective. Even though it really only treats a few gallons, it's just enough for drinking and cooking, which usually is enough for the average person in the course of the day. So that's an excellent question, one we get quite a bit. But what we're really chiefly concerned with here is congestion or drinking of water.
Can I just clarify your answer? Are you saying it doesn't? These species don't get
aerolized?
In terms of breeding?
Yeah, sure. No, our concern isn't with that. They're not volatile in the sense that they evaporate or come out of the water. In that sense, they're very large molecules, and they were designed to be soluble in water. That's how they're chiefly conveyed to the environment through the water. So we're not typically concerned with them though evaporating and coming out of the water into the air inside the home. That's not typically what we see with chemicals of this nature.
My name is Jack Riley, and I'm president and CEO of Pure Water Technology. I'm a professional in the water purification systems. I want to ask John Stein about the filters that you're using now, of the six filters, and also Kevin Safer, you had indicated that you had activated charcoal filters or granular charcoal filters. I'm not really sure. Our machines use carbon block filters, which have some adherence to pure water. Could you tell me which filters are being used on the test?
The filters, and I'm going to have Mr. Connery address specifics, but I believe we have both carbon black filters that were tested and then canister, but I'm going to let Mike give the complete answer to that.
When our committee selected the devices that were offered to us from the manufacturers, we tried to select different kinds of devices. So there are some carbon block devices, there are some granulated devices. The reverse osmosis, there are at least three different membranes that we look at. And in fact, one reverse osmosis had a resin as a post-filter. So we did try to intentionally get a mixture of different kinds of filters involved. The pollution control agency for a number of years has been installed in, not only in Lake Elmo for PFAS and PFOA, but I've used similar filters in Baytown and West Lakeland for trichloroethylene contamination. They've been using two 90-pound cylinders of granulated activated carbon, and those have in series. So when there's breakthrough on the first one, you take the first filter out, move the second filter up, and then put the second filter in there. And those have been monitored both at the at the midpoint and at the end. And as I said, when they begin to show some breakthrough at the midpoint, then they are they're rotated out. And they have a number of years of experience with those, and they've worked very effectively. Part of the difficulty with PFCs is, particularly with PFBA, they are not as readily absorbed onto carbon. And some of the smaller treatment units, for instance, like the pitcher filters you might have with a Brita filter at home, you simply do not have enough contact time to have a sufficient absorption. But those two 90-pound units that have been used, the contact times offset the relatively slow absorption rate that PFCs have.
I wanted to make a comment, and Mr. Stein, you can respond to this if you'd like to add to this. In response to Ms. Carlson's issue raising about things having lived here a long time, being present, being exposed to this for a period of time, and how that you're concerned with the number of studies that were done on TFDA levels out of that. When this issue arose last January, and we continued to develop our response to it, we asked the department very clearly, what will it take? How many studies? What type of studies for you to have the information you think you need to make a decision for a health case value for this particular chemical? And the answer was, in addition to the research that already exists on PFOA and PFOS, for PFDA we would want a longer study, 90-day study, and we want to see some of the additional developmental research. Now, my understanding, why that few studies can be adequate for the making of kind of decision is because there are over 1,500 scientific studies published on PFOA and PFOS, number one, including development studies, including pregnancy, including time in pregnancy, and on the offspring. And there are many, several of those right here. And we know something also about the relationship and the difference between PFDA and how it might be expected to behave or affect things versus those other chemicals that apparently much less toxic, and most important, very importantly, that has a really short half-life in the body relative to those other ones, days versus 5 to 6 years. Okay? And so based on that combination of things, this previous significant body of research on other chemicals, plus additional research on TFDA, it kind of tells us how it looks in relation to those other chemicals, also just what we know about the basic makeup of those molecules in relation to the chemicals, is why our health officials are telling us that this gives them a fairly adequate picture of this chemical and what, that's my understanding. And if you'd like to comment for that, I just want to say there is a large body of research on these other chemicals that are being used to make these decisions as well.
And Madam Chair, we
always work in a progressive fashion to deepen our understanding and knowledge. You're absolutely correct. What we asked for was provided. The information we received does lessen the extent of concerns that have been questions that have been asked because of the half-life differences between these compounds. That's a significant difference that will influence the department's determination of health-based value. Having said that, we always look for additional information to try to bring greater clarity whenever possible. And in the future, those types of studies may be beneficial. I don't want to rule them out as being less than helpful, but I think at this point where we're at is we're going to have sufficient amount of data to issue a health-based value.
Okay, well, please use it by time, and I hope this has been helpful to you. I'm going to just ask that question so there's some kind of comments that this hearing happened because she requested it, and I hope it was very useful.
Thank you, Chairman Clark, and thank you to my colleagues who came this evening. Many of you from long distances. Representative Tucker came all the way from the Rushford area where the flooding happened this summer, and Representative Peterson is from Bloomington, and Representative Bloomington. North Minneapolis. Yeah. So I do appreciate the distances that they travel. We also have several members of the House legislative staff here, and we have researchers, we have committee assistants. Again, I'm so grateful to you for being here as well. And thank you to the Department of Health and to the City Pollution Control Agency, who are wonderful, wonderful collaborators on these important issues. Thank you to my community. You always ask wonderful questions, and I am so proud to represent Woodbury and the kind of people that live here. And I hope that you feel free to contact me or Senator Saltzman or Representative Brown if you're from that part of Woodbury with specific questions. We would be more than happy to try to answer them or get the answers. So have a wonderful evening, and thank you so much for coming.